From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome. I'm Larry Mantle. On this week's program, our critics review the Netflix streaming action comedy, The Lovebirds. It stars Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. Michael Showalter directs the movie. The trip to Greece reteams Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan as themselves, taking a six-day journey through Greece. It's a part of a whole series of four films traveling around the world. Michael Winterbottom directs. And we'll hear about the Norwegian documentary, which tells a fascinating story, The Painter and the Thief. And our critics review Lucky Grandma, a film set in Manhattan's Chinatown. It's all coming up on this week's edition of Film Week.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us for this Memorial Day weekend. We're going to find out the best of what's available to stream at home, to watch on premium cable and satellite channels, and to go deep into the archives of what's available on multiple film websites. Joining us this week are critics Tim Cogshell of Cinegots.com and Alt Film Guide. Also with us from Mashable, Deputy Entertainment Editor and Film Critic Angie Hahn. We begin with The Lovebirds. A couple on the verge of breaking up gets caught up in a murder and becomes suspects themselves. The action comedy stars Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. The film is directed by Michael Showalter. Tim, what'd you think of The Lovebirds?
Well, I rather thoroughly enjoyed this zany film. Zany is a word that they used to describe movies. Oh, you can go all the way back to the 30s. Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell, His Gal Friday, you'd call them zany. You pop yourself up to like the 70s and you got Goldie Hawn, and she did two or three of them with Chevy Chase, Foul Play, zany movies. This movie is zany. So we have these people. When the movie opens, they're in love. They're so incredibly in love. They've just met. It's fantastic. And we fade to a card that says 4 years later. And they're in this insane fight in their living room over the great race and whether or not they could win the great race. He knows that they absolutely could not, and she thinks that they could. And of course, the fight is really over the fact that he thinks that they couldn't, and she thinks that they could. This is going to come up in this movie again and again and again. The next thing you know, people start dying. And it's just the funniest, silliest movie. It's a movie where everyone is talking fast and is being really sharp and witty. And you have to pay attention to it, because just like Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell back in the 30s, if you're not as sharp as they are, you're going to miss all of the funny.
The Lovebirds. Angie, what do you think?
I think Tim liked it a little bit more than I did, although I enjoyed it as well. So The Lovebirds was supposed to be a theatrical release, but it was moved to Netflix as a result of the pandemic. And it feels right at home on Netflix, for better or for worse. Like, I thought it was fun and funny. There were some really funny moments. I laughed a lot. And as Tim said, they have really good rapport and really good banter. But I also forgot about everything about it right after I saw it. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It does feel really lightweight coming from a team whose past credits include like The Big Sick, Insecure, Wet Hot American Summer, which are all things that really stayed with me after I saw them. But, you know, sometimes you need something that'll distract you for 90 minutes and not make you think too hard. And this is, it's fun.
Yeah, and Tim was talking about it reminded him of like those fast talking films with Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell, and with snappy dialogue. Did it remind you of that?
I don't know if that was the first comparison that I made in my head, but I do agree with Tim that I think the best parts of the film are just the chemistry they have together, kind of the best parts of the film are just them talking to each other. So as they're going through this adventure, they talk about everything from the amazing race, as Tim pointed out, to the extra milkshake that they give you at diners, because they always say they made too much, to the logistics of planning an orgy. So they talk about everything, and those parts are the most adorable parts of the movie, just sitting and watching them bounce off of each other and react off of each other and riff off of each other.
We're talking about the Netflix action comedy, The Lovebirds. It's written by Aaron Abrams and Brendan Gall. Michael Showalter, the director, stars Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. The film is rated R. The Trip to Greece is a British comedic drama starring Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan. Michael Winterbottom, the director. Tim?
Well, you know, as is the case with all of these trip films, they're very, 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 very funny, because these two guys are absolutely hysterical impressionists and really, really good sort of dramatists, too, for that matter. This film, like the other two films, are sort of culled together from a television program. These air as television as a television series in the UK. But they culled them together into these films. The first one was 10 years ago, believe it or not, The Trip. And they roamed around the UK going to all of these wonderful restaurants, sort of poking fun at each other and doing these impressions, and it was wonderful. And then they took the trip to Rome, and now we're going to Greece. This one, I think, is the best of the three, and this is why. There's a whole lot more real in this one than in the other two. You know, these guys are playing Rob and Steve, but they're not really playing themselves. They're playing versions of themselves. And there's a narrative thread that runs through these movies that have to do with things that are not actually happening in their actual lives. But when I like these movies the most, it's when they actually start to irritate each other. And suddenly you realize we're no longer in any kind of a movie. He is really getting on his nerves right now. and they have these little fights. And I think that that's when these movies get delightful. And by the third one, we get a whole lot of those moments. And I really like them a lot.
What do you think, Angie, of The Trip to Greece?
I can't decide if this is the best possible time to be watching this movie or the worst possible time. I guess it depends on what you really want. But, you know, as we're all trapped inside and unable to do things like travel or go to restaurants or see friends, I personally thought it was really nice to pretend for the duration of this movie that I was getting to do those things with these people. As Tim said, it's a series that's been going on for a while, so it feels really familiar. It feels like they are clearly very familiar with each other. They have a really strong rapport. You can tell that they've known each other for a long time. But if you've seen the previous movies, then you also feel like they are familiar faces. So that part of it was really nice.
All right. And for people who didn't see the first two trip films, Angie, do you recommend they go back to sort of see the evolution of the camaraderie, or as Tim's saying, even some of the real tension that comes through in this most recent film, or you just dive right into this one?
I have to admit, I haven't seen all of them. There are four in total, and I've only seen two of them. I don't think that you need to have seen them to understand what's going on. And they have a chemistry that is so immediately apparent that it doesn't need explanation. You don't need all the backstory. That said, I do think that it would add a little bit of an extra layer. You get to see a little bit more of the evolution of their friendship and the evolution of how these trips have been going, if you are familiar with the previous ones.
We're talking about The Trip to Greece, in which Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan play themselves. Michael Winterbottom, the director. The film is unrated, and you can see it on multiple on-demand platforms. The Painter and the Thief, a Norwegian documentary, the film directed by Benjamin Rhee. Angie?
So this is a really smart, sensitive documentary about an artist and the thief who stole two of her paintings, hence The Painter and the Thief. And it starts out seeming like maybe this is going to be a crime story, maybe it's going to be a heist thing, maybe it's going to be that kind of thing. But as you watch it, it becomes much more about the unlikely friendship that develops between these two people. And then even from there, it goes off in some unexpected directions. It ends up being about so much more than just these two paintings that were stolen. It ends up being about friendship and addiction and the power of art, but also the cost of art. And through it all, the spine of this movie is just this really rich and layered and complicated friendship between these two people who you wouldn't necessarily assume would be the best of friends, but end up having this really complex relationship. There's some real knockout moments in this movie that just blew me away. Like, so the artist start the artist decides that she's going to paint the thief. So she, the first time that she shows him one of her portraits of him, the reaction that he has, I can't even really describe it. It does feel like something that you have to watch this movie to experience it with him. It's full of powerful moments like that. I just really enjoyed this one. I thought it was fascinating.
What sort of paintings are we talking about? What is the art?
She tends to paint really large scale naturalistic portraits. Like one of the paintings that was stolen is a picture of a dead swan lying in some grass. The other one's a portrait of these two girls. She also does some portraits, like she does ones of the painter. The thief. She does ones of her. She has some self-portraits as well. So there's just these big oil paintings.
Tim, what do you think of the documentary, The Painter and the Thief?
Yeah, picking up where Angie leaves off, they're absolutely photorealistic paintings, what she does, these large-scale paintings, particularly the portraits. Her mastery of light is exquisite. She has a Vermeer-like talent, her. So you have to understand that these paintings are extraordinary. These were her two most famous paintings. These guys steal these paintings. They get caught. The thing that they don't know is where the hell the paintings are, because they were stoned out of their minds when they stole the paintings. And they didn't even really know each other. They just did, and she asked him, you know, she goes, decides I'm going to interact with him and all that. Why did you steal my painting? And he told her because it was beautiful. And that was his actual true answer. Where are my paintings? I have no idea. I don't remember. Now, over much of this film, as she's interacting with him, she doesn't really believe that. And that hurts him. That she doesn't believe him. And it's a thing that's always sort of in their friendship that she keeps coming back to, where are my paintings? And he keeps telling her, I have no idea. So there's this mystery going on here. There's actually a third person too. There were two people who stole those paintings. And the third guy, the second thief, comes into play too.
The Painter and the Thief from director Benjamin Reed. The documentary's Unrated. You can see it on virtual cinemas like the Fridas or Lemley's, also available on other video on demand services, and Hulu is streaming The Painter and the Thief as well. The comedic drama Lucky Grandma is a film that's streaming on multiple platforms. It's an American-made movie, but spoken mostly in Mandarin with English subtitles. The film is written and directed by Stacey Seeley. Angie, what'd you think of Lucky Grandma?
Well, one thing you didn't mention is that it's Seeley's directorial debut, and what a start. This is such a stylish, sharp movie with such a strong sense of the setting, which is Chinatown in Manhattan, and a strong sense of its characters. It's depending on what part of the movie you're watching, sometimes it's very sweet, sometimes it's very a little bit sad, sometimes it's even kind of scary. I had so much fun with this. I didn't know what to expect going in, and I walked away feeling like I need to see more of what she does next. So Sai Chin, I believe that's her name, stars as the lucky grandma of the title, who goes to a fortune teller and is told, oh, you're going to have some really great luck coming your way. So she goes to the casino, bets all her money. And at first it seems to be going well, but then after that, it's not going so well. And she ends up in possession of a large sum of money that doesn't really belong to her. It turns out to belong to a Chinatown gangster. And then because she's holding onto the money, she spends the rest of the movie being chased around by these gangsters. And the tone feels a little bit Coen-y, I think, is the obvious comparison. Maybe just because it's crime plus dark comedy plus all these colorful characters, but her style feels very Edgar Wright to me. I mean, it feels like her own, but she has that sense of rhythm, you know, very snappy, and that sense of composition, very eye catching. You can tell a lot of care went into it. But I have to go back real quick again to Sai Chin, who is just the best part of this movie. She's the main character, and she's the focal point of all of it, and she's just sharp as a tack. She oozes charisma, even as she's playing someone who is usually ignored by society and often uses that to her advantage. You can't stop watching her.
Well, I was going to say, a movie like this, where it sounds like it's really less about the plot, you're looking for funny vignettes, to have a strong lead like this who really breaks out and gives you a funny performance, it sounds like this is a real gift for a first-time director to have a star like that.
Yeah, from the first time that you see this lead character with a cigarette dangling from her lips like she's Clint Eastwood or something. I was all in.
The film is Lucky Grandma, a dark comedy or comedic drama. The film is unrated. Once again, it's an American film set in New York City, but it's spoken mostly in Mandarin with English subtitles. Tsai Chin, the star of the film. The film is directed by Stacey Seeley in her feature directorial debut, and she co-wrote the screenplay with Angela Cheng. The film is available on virtual cinemas, including Lemley's and the Frida's Virtual Cinemas, and available on video on demand as well. Coming up, we'll hear our critics' reviews of the biographical thriller Mr. Jones. It's based on the life of Gareth Jones, follows him as a young journalist. He gets a tip that could expose an international conspiracy. The film directed by Agnieszka Holland. We'll also hear about the documentary Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy. Diana Kennedy, now in her 90s, a cookbook author and environmental activist. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, and podcasting wherever you get your favorite podcasts. It's Film Week, and we'll be back in just 1 minute.
As a farmer's son from a desert region in California, J.B. Hamby thinks a lot about water.
I spent a lot of time digging up history, particularly about water, which is the origins of the Imperial Valley.
How this 28-year-old became the youngest lead negotiator on the Colorado River ever, and how he could shape the most consequential negotiations to date. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
So good to have you with us on this Memorial Day weekend for Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Angie Hahn of Mashable. Also with us is Tim Cogshell, our film critic, who joins us from Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. Our next movie is Mr. Jones. It's a biographical thriller starring Peter Sarsgaard, James Norton, and Vanessa Kirby. Agnieszka Holland is the director, and the screenwriter is Andrea Chalupa. Tim, what'd you think of Mr. Jones?
Well, this is a very slowly rendered historical biodrama about a figure who's mostly been forgotten to history. Gareth Jones died a very young man. He is the first person to report firsthand about the Soviet famine from 1932 to 1933 that took place in the Ukraine. Malcolm Muggeridge had been reporting about it through accounts, but he, played by Mr. Norton in this film, managed to get himself to Russia and then get himself to the Ukraine and actually witness this man-made famine firsthand. And that's the important part about it. It was a man-made constructed famine that killed millions and millions and millions of Ukrainians. And it was a story that was just completely new to the Western world. This is a sort of very slow account of how he managed to pull all of this out off. And it walks right up to the point of his very early death at the age of not even 30, at 29, in 1935.
Mr. Jones is the film. It's available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, and next month it's going to be out on additional video-on-demand platforms. It's unrated. The documentary Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy, is directed by Elizabeth Carroll. Angie, who is Diana Kennedy?
Well, I didn't know the answer to that either, to be honest with you, before I started watching this movie. But now I know that she is a British chef who is credited with changing how the rest of the world thought about regional Mexican cuisine. Obviously, Mexican cuisine has always existed in Mexico, and obviously people outside of Mexico have known about it for a while too. But what she did was she traveled to Mexico. She went all around the country to all these different regions. She talked to the people who were making food the traditional way and learned how to do that herself. And then she went out and spread the word about those techniques and these dishes to the rest of the world. So that is what she's known for.
All right. Share with us how the documentary profiles her.
It picks up with her now. She's in her 90s, so it finds her at her home in Mexico. I think it said she lives about 100 miles outside Mexico City, just to situate you. And it follows her around as she just talks about her life, as she goes about her day. You see her going to markets and talking to people. And it also gets some people, it also talks to some chefs and other such people who were influenced by her, so that we can get a little bit context for who she is. It's a really likable documentary, even if you don't know anything about her. As I said, I didn't. She's a really compelling subject, partly because her life was fascinating and partly because she's done a lot, and also just because she's really fun to watch. She's prickly, but she's very charismatic. I feel like I could watch her talk for a long time and never be bored. Much like The Trip, there's also lots of excellent scenery and shots of food and plants, which I'm just going to get real personal for a second and just say I watched this documentary on a week when I was supposed to be vacationing in Mexico, so that was a little bit bittersweet for me.
Yeah, so it just gives you a taste of it, so to speak.
Yeah, so I was like, this is what I was supposed to be doing this week. How sad for me. But the one thing I will say that is that if you're looking for kind of more in-depth analysis of food culture, and if you want a discussion about cultural appropriation, which I think is an obvious issue that might come to mind when you're watching this documentary, it doesn't really get into that. It just ends up being more about her and the work that she did do without kind of looking at the larger cultural context, maybe, that it could have.
We're talking about Diana Kennedy, Nothing Fancy. The documentary's unrated, and you can see it through Lemley's Virtual Cinemas. Military Wives, a British comedic drama starring Kristen Scott Thomas and Sharon Horgan. Peter Cataneo is the director. Roseanne Flynn and Rachel Tunnard are the screenwriters. Tim?
Yeah, it is a comedic drama, a good dose of both here. Peter Cataneo, The Full Monty, 1997, was his sort of big hit film. And it occurs to me that this film and several films that he's made in between are kind of like the same movie, in that they all have a group of people who are brought together, who are a disparate group, who have to learn to do something together in order to overcome their circumstances. In this particular case, all of these British military wives are watching their husbands go off to yet another tour in the Afghanistan war. Kristen Scott Thomas, her husband is the commander of all of these people. And she's already had a son go to that war, and she lost a son in that war. So she's coming at this from a different sort of spot. Miss Horrigan, her husband is going off to the war, but she's never been involved with any of this kind of stuff before in her life. So it's all very new to her. They're going to start this choir. And the way this choir is going to work is the same way that little dance troupe worked in The Full Monty 20 plus years ago, where they're not going to be very good at all to begin with. But when they start to pull together and everybody does what they do best, they're going to get better and they're going to get better. And there's going to be a big performance at the end of this movie, just like there was at the end of The Full Monty.
But they're dressed in this one, presumably.
Well, everybody has their clothes on. But that theme, and it's just funny, you watch a person's career over, 25 years, and you start to see these themes that pop up in their films. And Peter here, he has a theme that he likes, and he does it very well. I like this movie.
We're talking about Peter Cataneo's movie Military Wives, starring Kristen Scott Thomas and Sharon Horgan. Angie, what do you think?
I found it to be kind of fun and kind of touching without ever being all that interesting. I mean, I had a good time. I wasn't upset while I was watching it, but it also just felt kind of predictable. As Tim points out, it feels like a movie that we have seen several times before, for better or for worse. Sometimes you're in the mood for something a little bit familiar, so in those cases, maybe it feels nice and cozy. But if you're looking for something that's going to surprise you, this is probably not it. I think a lot of the emotion just comes from the situation itself. You can't not feel for these very nice people, some of whom are played by Sharon Horgan and Kristen Scott Thomas, who we're always happy to see. You can't help but feel bad for them that they are in this really stressful situation of having spouses who are off at war. When it seems like there might be bad news, you can't help but, get worried for them. And then when they're happy that their thing is going well, you can't help but feel happy for them. But aside from that, it just didn't feel like it really did enough to earn its laughs or its tears. I wished that it had a little bit more personality or pizzazz to make up for it. So it wasn't bad, but I didn't find it to be super satisfying.
We're talking about the British dramatic comedy Military Wives. The film's rated PG-13. It's available streaming on Hulu, on several video on demand platforms, and Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The documentary Kate Nash, Underestimate the Girl, follows British pop star Kate Nash. Amy Goldstein, the director. Tim.
Yeah, I first came across Kate Nash in a film called Greetings from Tim Buckley, 2012, in which she had a small but very important role, and her presence was asserted, and I felt it. Well before that, she had been this big British pop star when she was very, very young, 2005, 6, 7, something like that. Big old gigantic hit song called Foundation. And I went back and listened to it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that song, and a whole bunch more. Well, she had this moment in her career where the sort of online trolling and other kinds of trolling got so bad that she just left the industry altogether. She had been in a couple of television shows, had even made a small movie or two by that point, was really on her way. And, you know, the things sort of worked out the way they worked out, and she got herself steadied again. And about the time she turned 30, she decided she wanted to come back. And this movie picks up there, and we follow her on her comeback road. And it's really fascinating to watch how she negotiates all of this, knowing what she knows now, being 32 rather than 22. She's on the hit series Glow now, and she's a wonderful actress, and she's got another record coming out, and you know her music, and this is sort of an interesting look at how a young woman negotiates all of that and comes back stronger for it.
Well, and one of the challenges I would think, Tim, is just psychologically to go from that position where you're riding high and then your life changes dramatically, either through choice or outside circumstances, and then you decide you want to rebuild up, if not to that point, at least take the same path. And does this film do a good job of exploring that psychology?
I really think that it does, because we work our way back and forth between, you know, 10, 15 years ago when she was very young. Obviously, she was a pop star, so there's lots of footage of her talking and thinking about things then, to her sitting and talking and thinking about those exact same things now at the age of 32. We see how she handles some of the equivalent things. She spent some time homeless. So she reports that being homeless can also make you fearless, because what's the worst thing that can happen to you? You're homeless again.
And she survived that.
I did that already. So, there's a real sharpness there that I really think is useful. And, you know, I would recommend a lot of young women watch this movie, Kate Nash.
Kate Nash, Underestimate the Girl, is the documentary, British doc. The film is unrated. Amy Goldstein is the director. And you can see it on the Alamo On Demand video platform. Also want to take some time to remember two outstanding figures in the entertainment community who we lost within the past week. Fred Willard, the comedic actor who we know from so many films, decades of creative output, including This Is Spinal Tap, Best in Show, Anchorman. He died earlier this week at the age of 86. He was just a tremendously funny person. I know even from having the opportunity to talk with him off screen, just a very, very interesting, mind always going kind of person. In WALL-E, he voiced the character Shelby Forthright, the CEO of the big box chain By and Large. So many great performances. But he first came to my attention back with a Norman Lear parody of a late night talk show that was called Fernwood Tonight, set in the small town of Fernwood, Ohio. And Fred Willard played the announcer and sidekick, Jerry Hubbard, on that 1977 TV show. Martin Mull played Barth Gimble, the host of the show. And in this scene, Barth is suffering from whiplash after a car accident. Fred Willard's Jerry tells him how everyone at the station is hoping for his speedy recovery.
Boy, you're a real trooper. You're on the job even with that, huh?
That's what they pay me for.
And you know, everyone here is really rooting for you. On my way up, I heard everyone in the building saying, "Will we be glad when that pain in the neck is gone?" You know, anyone else in your position might consider just staying home. You might even think about that. Letting me fill in for you here.
Yeah, I'm sure you've thought of that, Jerry.
From Fernwood Tonight, a very funny Norman Lear show that was syndicated across the country. Tim, your thoughts about our loss of Fred Willard?
Larry, we give away our ages because me and you and Fernwood tonight and Fred Willard, that, we both starred in the exact same spot in 1970. I loved watching that show in the Midwest in the middle of the night, watch him and Martin Mull. In the very early 90s, when I got here, Fred Willard would go to the comedy sketch little clubs all over town. They were everywhere, up in the valley, at the White Fire and every place. And I had all of these buddies who were in these sketch comedy classes. And if Fred Willard knew one single person in that class, he would show up and he would sit through the entire show well after the person who he came to see performed. And he would stand around for 20 minutes afterwards. And this is in the 90s, and talk to everybody who did everything there. That was Fred Willard.
Yeah, is so beloved by his fellow actors and comedians. Angie, your thoughts about Willard's passing?
I was really taken aback when I heard news that he had passed away, because to me, he has just always felt like someone who was always around in everything all the time. And I guess on some level, I assume that he always would be. You know, he's, as you point out, he has a really long list of credits. He's been in so many movies. He's been in so many TV shows. Sometimes he has a bigger role. Sometimes he has. But a lot of times he just shows up for a little tiny role and he just sprinkles some of that Fred Willard goodness into whatever he's doing. I think over the course of his career, he really perfected this type of character, this clueless but essentially well-meaning guy. And so every time he showed up, I always felt like, oh, there's Fred Willard. He's going to do his Fred Willard thing. And yet somehow it never felt like it was too predictable. I think he knew what he was doing, but always managed to bring something a little bit new and something a little bit unexpected to anything he was in.
Steve Carell tweeted, "Fred Willard was the funniest person I've ever worked with. He was a sweet, wonderful man." The news came last Saturday, last weekend, that Fred Willard, with a 50-year career in films, all those great Christopher Guest movies like Best in Show, that he had died at the age of 86. He died peacefully of natural causes. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. Coming up, we'll remember director Lynn Shelton. Feature films and television directing credits. She, too, died just a few days ago. We'll talk about her legacy as well. Though much younger than Willard, she made quite an impression. Back shortly. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We were just remembering Fred Willard, who died just over a week ago, and also passing within just about 8 or 9 days ago, director Lynn Shelton. She died at the age of 54 of a previously unidentified blood disorder. She was known for her work on independent films like Hump Day and Sword of Trust. She directed episodes of TV series like Mad Men and Glow. And very highly regarded for her directorial skills, and posted to YouTube just a few days before she died was a clip from an online seminar. This was recorded earlier this month. She was talking with fellows at the American Film Institute about what she learned from her time on Little Fires Everywhere and about the process of pitching shows to networks and producers.
One of the things I found out was, again, just putting out that little bit of extra effort. I saw this too when I saw other directors trying to get, because there were two other directors who directed the other episodes I didn't do on Little Fires. And we went through this whole long process. So many people came in just to pitch for those. And the producers were just so, they really, really wanted people who had done their homework and who knew the scripts or whatever material they'd been given, were able to analyze, you know, deconstruct, describe what they saw, whether it was in character detail or, you know, visions for how it might come together visually.
Director Lynn Shelton speaking to fellows at the American Film Institute just days before she passed away. Angie Hahn, your thoughts about the creative output of Shelton?
I think I became aware of Shelton probably around the same time a lot of other people did when Hump Day came out. And I remember that came out at a time when there were so many broader comedies about romances and guy friends kind of doing this thing where they were really super close, but it was a little bit weird and whatnot. And then Hump Day takes that romance and really pushes it to the absolute limit by having these two straight guys decide to have sex on camera to enter a porn contest. And she takes that premise and she finds this, the humanity in there. She digs into so much of the little things that inform it, like the fragility of masculinity, the competing macho drives between these characters, right, but also the sincere affection and intimacy between them. And she does all this without having to kind of get on a soapbox and spell it all out. It's just in the way that she observes them. It's just in their little interactions.
Tim, you have a quick favorite work of Lynn Shelton?
I particularly love the way when as an actress, she would enter a scene, she would bring this level of exuberance with her. In Hump Day, you can see it. In Laggies, you can see it too. And her work as a director is really, really excellent. Folks should pick up on some of the work that she did on Shameless, a series that she worked on, as well as The Good Place. And all of the shows that are sort of touchstones of the culture today, she insinuated a certain sort of joy and happiness that was just her personality into all of that stuff. I interviewed her many times, and she was the exact sort of personality that she presented on screen.
Again, director Lynn Shelton dying just a few days ago at the age of 54. For almost 25 years, Chris Marcus and Steve McFeely have been writing movies together, including the two latest Avengers movies, three Captain America pictures, and the Chronicles of Narnia. With worldwide receipts over $9 billion, their chemistry has made them the most successful screenwriters ever. But then came the pandemic. From their respective home offices, they told KPCC's John Raby how working apart is affecting their new project with the directing partners, the Russo brothers.
Chris and I have been a writing team since 96 when we moved to town, and we've been, the system we have is, it's like in thirds, and the middle third can be apart, but we outline things together in the same room with whiteboards and stuff, and then we write the first draft separately for 5-6 weeks, and then we come together and we sit over each other's shoulder and rewrite stuff together.
Yes, and those first and third chunks can be 10 hours long, just stranded in a room somewhere. I mean, one, there's all sorts of home obligations. You can't get a 10-hour chunk to save your life, but it's also, I can't do 3 hours seems to be the max on Zoom before, like, my brain goes elsewhere. You know, there's a barrier there. So we've been having daily 3-hour-ish Zoom calls with the Russo brothers, and I don't know. It's about a half as productive as it used to be.
Do you miss each other?
I miss the efficiency, and I miss the daily. Yeah, they made daily camaraderie. And I think this is so stressful. So I'm getting, Chris is getting a slightly more anxious Steve, and I know I'm getting a slightly more anxious Chris. You know?
I don't even know if I would define this as anxiety so much as just like...
despair?
No, just stress. Just like high-grade, pure stress.
Yeah.
I'm not worried. I'm just like harried. There's a 7-year-old waiting to do handwriting with me downstairs, and it's just mayhem.
So you're not getting as much done, but do you think it's affecting the quality of your work?
It's not yet, I don't think, but we're outlining a big project. And so that would normally be the four of us in a room, and I would be writing on whiteboards, and we'd look at it and say, no, erase, and keep going and build. And that building is harder to sort of all take in together. So it's the four of us just sort of shooting ideas, and I kind of try to keep it in some sort of organized place. But it's much more piecemeal than it used to be. You used to be able to step back and look at Act Two altogether and go, oh, but now it's unless I somehow turn my office into whiteboards, we haven't been able to do that yet.
There's also, there's a in person and in an office, there's I don't know if you can hear the screaming, but yes, we're home. There's an unconscious or subconscious absorption of information where the stuff is all around you. You're absorbing the story. You're getting an innate sense of what you're building and of what's going on with the project from seeing people in the hallway and stuff. I feel like grossly uninformed right now. There are gaps in my knowledge just because I don't have the subconscious part, and I don't have the conscious part either, because I literally have those 3 hours, and there's no time outside of that where I can do work. So it is a much more piecemeal, as Steve said, I think once we get to writing, it'll work fairly well. It'll take longer, probably, but...
And just to make sure here, the project you're talking about with the Russo brothers, this really is top secret? You can't reveal anything to our listeners?
No, it's a super top secret secret. We started a studio together. You know, we've been working together for quite a while now.
It's going to be great. It's all about backyard gardening. It's a trilogy.
Okay, fine. I guess we'll just have to wait. Lastly, away from work, are you doing anything to keep your mind off the pandemic?
Certainly since the quarantine has started, but even, you know, in the last 4 or so years, you get so inundated with the horrible reality of our present day that I've been reading more and more things that take place farther in the past. And since quarantine has happened, I think I've read every single Sherlock Holmes book because it has absolutely no relation to the present day. And, you know, when I fall into the bed, it's like, I'm going to open this book where none of this is happening. Carriages are the accepted form of transportation, and that's fine. And it does give me a nice little break from reality before I fall asleep. And it's also nice to remember that back then you could die in so many ways. Like, we're all upset about this current thing, but like, I don't think they would have blinked back then. It's just like, they're just living in filth and cholera.
Screenwriters Chris Marcus and Steve McFeely, who wrote a number of the films in Marvel's Avengers series, talking with KPCC's John Raby. Don't go anywhere. Ahead on Film Week, an interview with the director of the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary on Lance Armstrong.
After their loss, she and her husband helped push for a new category of leave.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LA's senior education reporter, Ellie Yu. I focus on early childhood, the critical years that shape the rest of a child's life. And I help parents and caregivers grappling with the challenging and often inequitable childcare landscape.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Lance Armstrong's story is well known. The American professional cyclist beat cancer, won his sport's biggest, most grueling race, the Tour de France, 7 times, a record from 1995 to 2001, but became a social pariah after publicly admitting in 2013 he'd used performance-enhancing drugs throughout his run. Since then, Armstrong has mostly avoided the spotlight, leaving only speculation as to his side of the story. But that's changing. This weekend, ESPN debuts Part 1 of Lance, a 2-part documentary in their acclaimed 30 for 30 series. Director Marina Zenovich stitches together footage from her hours of interviews with Lance's former teammates, support staff, friends, and with Armstrong himself. He talks about his rise to fame, his fall from grace, and how he's processed it all.
Were we getting injections of vitamins and other things like that at an earlier age? Yes, but they weren't illegal. So that, you know.
But did you know?
Know what?
What was in those?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. Come on. I'm not one of those guys. I was like, whoa, what do we have here? I always asked. I always knew. And I always made the decision on my own. Nobody said, don't ask. This is what you're getting. That I never, ever would have gone for that. I educated myself on what was being given, and I chose to do it.
The Frame's John Horn interviewed Zenovich last week, and he began by asking her if the movie she wanted to make and the movie Armstrong wanted were the same.
Well, I thought they were, and I think maybe for Lance in a few years, he'll think that they are. But I think that in his heart of hearts, as much as he's processed and as much as we connected and as much as he wanted to talk, he was guarded. And he had the intention to get things off his chest, but I don't know if he kind of knew who he was working with, in the sense that it's really a bit of a dance, an elaborate fencing match. It's, you know, we're both trying to get what we want. And I was under the impression that he was cool with what I wanted. But I don't know if he was in the end.
Because in some ways it feels as much a psychological profile as an athletic profile. And it feels like so much of your film is about Lance Armstrong trying to wrap himself around what he did and how what he did was received.
Yeah, and I think we caught him mid-process. I don't know if he understands what he did or wants to face it. I think he tries, but I don't think that's something you can sit with 24/7. I think that's something that, you know, you do try to rationalize because there was ugly behavior. I tried to see the best in Lance, knowing what he did. I didn't experience what he did, but I spoke to people about what he did. I'm trying to humanize Lance Armstrong, which some people just don't want to hear because of what he did. But that is my job as a documentary filmmaker, to go deeper and try to get my subject to see themselves and understand what they've done. Did he see that? Maybe he did. I hope he did. He said, ask me anything. That's heaven to me, to be able to just go there. And I felt like he was willing to go there. Yes, he was guarded. He didn't want to say some things, but I feel like he said a lot as well.
Everybody who was racing pretty much at the time was on some sort of performance-enhancing drug and lied about it. But what Lance Armstrong did was different. He not only lied about it, he went after the people who said he was cheating. And that included people like Betsy Andreu, who was married to a former teammate of Lance's, Frankie Andreu, and Emma O'Reilly, who was his therapist. So it feels like part of what Lance is doing, and I think more so with Emma than with Betsy, is he is finally, with great reluctance, apologizing to the people whose lives he destroyed, including Greg LeMond, another cyclist whose bike line Lance Armstrong essentially put out of business. It feels like he's trying to apologize to the people that he went after.
He is trying. Some of those people would say, you're not trying hard enough. Some of those people would accept his apology. I mean, what was fascinating about this journey was to see how different people responded in different ways. How some people like Emma O'Reilly, his physical therapist, masseuse, was able to get past it. That's who she is as a person. I mean, ultimately it comes down to who you are. And, you know, Betsy, I think, just can't get past it. And I understand why. But you get to this core issue of he's trying as much as he can. Some people say, well, he's not trying enough. He's trying as much as he can. And there has to be some, you just have to let it go at some point, I think. But I say that knowing that he didn't do anything to me.
Lance Armstrong gave you incredible physical access. You are with him with his family. You're with him in various private moments. You're with him in the kitchen. But it feels like one of the rare moments where he really becomes emotionally available to you is when he's talking about Jan Ullrich. Jan Ullrich is a great rider who was probably Lance's number one rival. He's from Germany, and he was caught for doping, and his life really spiraled downward quickly. What was it about the conversation with Jan Ullrich that became so powerful in this film?
Well, I just want to say that Lance ended up talking about Jan at a moment in one of our interviews where I was all set to go through the cancer story with him. And I was nervous about it and really needed, when someone has talked about something so many times, you really need to get them to a place of going deep. And so I wanted to talk about that. And he looked at his watch and said, you have 10 minutes left. And I said, oh my God, I was going to ask you about cancer. You can't tell that whole story in 10 minutes. So We had been talking about Jan and the fact that he was suffering, so I just, like, grabbed whatever I could thought I could think of and said, you know, why did you go to Germany to see Jan Ullrich? And we all were just blown away by his response, because kind of by accident, I ended up touching something in him, which was how he felt about Jan. And he went into a very emotional moment where it's not like I was trying to get him to cry. I mean, it's not like my goal. I'm trying to get people to be in touch with what they're saying and what they're feeling. And you want people to be emotional. But I think for him, you know, what happened to Jan could have happened to Lance. And after that moment with Lance, I have to say that I think he really enjoyed going deep. And I think he has, I don't want to say enjoyed, but I think he has appreciated the process of trying to figure out who he is and what he did and coming to terms with it. And you can't say that about everyone. So am I defending him? No, I'm just stating a fact. But I thoroughly enjoyed not only talking to Lance, but talking to all these cyclists, George Hincapie, Tyler Hamilton, Ivan Basso, you know, Floyd Landis. These guys have amazing stories to tell. And I'm really proud of this work.
Marina Zenovich is the producer and director of the documentary Lance. Marina, thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, John.
Director Marina Zenovich talking with KPCC's John Horn about her new two-part ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Lance. You can see part one live on ESPN this Sunday night at 6. Part two airs Sunday, May 31st, also at 6 o'clock Pacific. Both are available on demand via ESPN Plus immediately following the broadcast. Thanks so much for joining us. From all of us at Film Week, have a safe and happy Memorial Day weekend.